So this is Quantafuel 33. It's not a very descriptive name, but we'll see what it is. So my name is Jaume Gomis. I'm a faculty member here at PI. And my office number is 427. So if you want to come and ask me questions, you can come and see me there. Even though I much prefer if you ask me questions during the lecture. And if you don't ask me questions, I will ask you questions. So it's your choice. Good. Yeah, so I guess that in the first part of the course, I'll describe, I'll write down the word, conformal field theory. So you're definitely familiar with a subset of the words here. Field theory, so we'll have to understand what do I mean by conformal. And in today's lecture, essentially, I'll just give like a very high level perspective on this subject, why it's important and interesting. Kind of tell you a story of how this enters in theoretical physics and also mathematics, and why it's an important subject. And then in later lectures, we will develop it more systematically, the study of the subject. Okay. Please stop me anytime if something is not clear, even though I have not said anything yet. But okay, so the most basic thing we want to do is study field theories that have the property that they are conformal. Okay. So what this means is that we're going to study quantum field theory. Okay. So and the acronym for this we're going to use is CFT, which I'm sure you've seen. Usually paired with ADS, but okay. So, what is a conformal field theory? Essentially, it's a quantum field theory with additional space-time symmetries. Okay. So there are two things I want to emphasize here. So quantum field theory, you have some understanding of it. You've been taking some courses. And then the key word here is that these are theories that have additional symmetries, but not just any old symmetries, space-time symmetries. So this is to be distinguished from other symmetries you have seen in your courses, like global symmetries associated to like what we call internal symmetries. So for example, if you have a complex scalar field, and you have a potential that's reasonable, that theory has a U1 symmetry that rotates the scalar field. But this is not a space-time symmetry. It acts on internal quantum numbers of your degrees of freedom. While space-time symmetries act on space-time. Okay? They generate a non-trivial transformation on space-time. So you're familiar with many of them. You studied a lot the Poincaré symmetry. So that's translations and Lorentz transformations. So what we're seeking is theories that have space-time symmetries beyond a Poincaré. More generally, you can also have a notion of conformal field theory in Galilean invariant theories that are not relativistic. And there we would also seek additional symmetries beyond the Galileo. Does anyone know what the Galileo group is? Okay, so it's the what you knew before, that's what you studied in undergraduate, essentially. Even though maybe they didn't tell you, but for example, these are the symmetries of Newton's equations, for example. Okay? And one important thing about the space-time symmetries that if you don't have thought about it, and you will develop a very clear understanding, these are symmetries that are generated by a crucial operator in any local quantum field theory, which is called the energy momentum tensor. Okay. This is distinguished by symmetries that are not space-time symmetries that also have an associated Noether current, but is not written. It cannot be written in terms of the energy momentum tensor. Okay. Good. Now, I think we all know even from undergraduate physics that how important symmetries are when you study physics. So, for example, even symmetries are important. And essentially, these curves are, imply constraints. And essentially, in this course, what we're going to do is use to the maximal power the effect of symmetries to constrain as much as possible the dynamics of a quantum field theory. You will see that in conformal in theories that have these extra symmetries, the kinds of correlation functions or observables that the theory can hire are very much constrained by the symmetries. So you have, in the space of all possibilities, you've reduced to a much smaller space. Okay. One philosophical thing to say, of course, is that symmetries alone is just kinematics. So what symmetries allow you to do is to parameterize the most general possible solution of your theory. But then you need some other physical principle that actually gives you the solution. Okay. And in conformal field theories, we will study that. That's called the crossing equation. That's a dynamical input that, together with the constraints from conformal symmetry, will allow us to, just by pure thought, solve quantum field theories. Okay. Good. So, finally, in classical mechanics, you know that if you start with something like this, it's called Newton's equation. You know that the equations of motion are second order. So you have to solve this. But you know that if the system has time translational invariance, energy is conserved. And you can write something like, okay? So the existence of a symmetry, of a space-time symmetry. It tells you that you can solve for the dynamics of your particle, not by solving a second-order differential equation, but by solving a first-order differential equation. I'm going to problem those. Okay, so that's one example in which that you know very familiar, that how symmetries can drastically simplify your problem. By the end of one of these lectures, maybe I'll give you an exercise to show that if you pick your potential to be of a very special type, you can go one step more. You can essentially determine X in terms of two conserved quantities. One will be the energy that you're very familiar with, and the other one is a quantity that you'll become familiar with very soon. Okay? So that's an example of which there is so much symmetry and conserved charges that the motion of the particle is completely fixed once you tell me the conserved charges. Algebraically fixed. And then I could give you many examples in quantum mechanics, but I think that gives you an idea. I just want to give you a flavor of how symmetries really inform dynamics. Okay. So in a relativistic quantum field theory, usually when we talk about quantum field theory, we mean relativistic, but I'll be open-minded for now. The space, the use, essentially any relativistic quantum field theory is invariant under the Poincaré group. More precisely, so I'll use some words that you probably have heard, it's what's known as the proper orthogonal subgroup of the Lorentz group. Okay, there are symmetries in Poincaré that in the Poincaré group that may or may not be symmetries of your theory, like parity or time reversal. But yeah, let's not get carried away with details. Let's say Poincaré, but keep in mind that there are discrete symmetries that may not be there, like time reversal. In a non-relativistic, there's something already said. You would have the Galileo group. And actually, the two are related. You're familiar with this word. You can go from the Poincaré algebra to the Galilei algebra, but by taking the C goes to infinity limit. And mathematically, it means that you do a contraction. So you take the Lie algebra of the Poincaré group, you do a clever rescaling, and you land on the Galilei group. Physically, what you're doing is you're taking the limit in which your velocity is much smaller than the speed of light. And you land on your feet with something that, you know, that if you take a relativistic particle and you expand it around small velocities, you get the non-relativistic dispersion relation. Okay, so now what I'm saying is that what we want to do is study theories that have, depending on your setup, these symmetries plus extra. So let me discuss a little bit what these extra symmetries are. Okay. Before saying that, again, this will be discussed very systematically starting the next lecture. So let me say a statement that's kind of very powerful. I'm not going to prove it. But essentially, you can ask, okay, given a relativistic theory. So given a relativistic field theory, you could say, what is the largest space-time symmetry that a theory can have while still being non-trivial? Being non-trivial means that it's not a free field theory. Free field theories, like phi square, I mean, free scalar field theory, free field theories can have all kinds of stupid symmetries because they're very special, but we call them trivial because essentially all observables are determined by the two-point function, okay? There are no interactions, everything is determined by the two-point function. So the statement is that the conformal symmetry, so this is a slogan, conformal symmetry is the largest possible symmetry, space-time symmetry, of a non-trivial, quantum field theory. Okay. So if you're in the business of finding out what is the most general symmetry that you can have, you land on this. I'm lying a little bit. If you allow your symmetry generators to be have non-trivial spin, then instead of conformal symmetry, you get super conformal symmetry. So supersymmetry entangled with conformal symmetry. Okay. So this already tells you, it puts an upper bound of how much we can look. Okay. I'm not proving this, but this is an important statement. So this already places conformal theories in a very special place. These are the most symmetric theories that are non-trivial that we can study. Okay. So, but since I like to write correct things mostly, the actual statement is that it's super conformal symmetry. So you probably have not seen supersymmetry yet, but or you won't. But that's a potential symmetry that are allowed in relativistic quantum field theories. Actually, also non-relativistic quantum field theories. Okay, so now let's study conformal transformations. So I think you're of course very familiar with Poincaré, so I don't have to discuss that. And I'm going to pick the most elementary conformal transformation that you all have an intuition with, which is a scale transformation. So this is a transformation in a rotational invariant system that rotates the spatial coordinates in this way. Essentially, it's like doing zooming in and zooming out of a space-time region. In a non-relativistic system, time can rescale with a different power, okay? And this Z is called a dynamical critical exponent. Okay, can someone tell me what Z is in a relativistic field theory?
One,
because, because X and T are on the same footing in a relativistic field theory. So Z equals one in relativistic QFT. Can someone tell me what Z is for the free Schrödinger equation? So free Schrödinger equation has a scale symmetry. And actually, if you add a potential of a very special type, it also still has a scale symmetry. But let's forget about the potential for a second. Okay, that potential is very closely related to the potential that I want you to figure out at some point. But let's just consider the free Schrodinger equation. It has a scale symmetry. Do you remember what the Schrodinger equation is? Yeah, 2. So why is there a 2?
Because there's a partial derivative, one partial derivative t and two partial.
Perfect. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes. So it's z equals 2. But I want to tell you that in there can be non-trivial, non-relativistic Galilean invariant theories where z can take other values. Okay, so it's kind of an important observable to take into account. Okay. So a scale transformation. So the question is, can a theory be invariant that is scale transformations? And your most basic intuition is that most theories are not invariant under scale transformations, because most theories, well, actually, okay, many theories in nature have an intrinsic scale in them. Like they have a scale, like the QCD scale. That's a dimensionful parameter that gives masses to particles, for example. And obviously, physics is not invariant under scale transformations if you have a mass scale, okay? But thinking about scales, even if the theory is not scale invariant, is very important in quantum field theory or in physics in general. And actually, that's how we organize our thoughts when we think about the physical problem. So I'll make another little detour to connect with things you probably have seen, but maybe it will be helpful. So whenever we study a physical problem, let's imagine you want to study some system like water. In order to describe that system, first we have to decide what length scales you want to probe, okay? Because your answer will depend very sensitively on the length scale that you're probing. For example, if you want to study water at a coarse level, it will sufficient to use hydrodynamics. Okay. You want to study a flow of water by studying Navier-Stokes equations. But now imagine you go to shorter and shorter distances where you start studying the granularity, the fact that water is made out of molecules. Then you may have to change to a different description, like some kind of Schrodinger equation where you have, I'm not saying this is a useful description, but that's the one you would have to describe. Furthermore, if you go to even shorter distances, like to the size of the proton, you may have to worry about quantum chromodynamics, like the strong nuclear force, okay? So all this to say is that when we study a physical system, we always, even though you may not have thought about it, you always have to think of what energy scale am I probing, okay? And one very important thing in physics that we'll come back to later, we will formulate in a more mathematical way, is that it's kind of a gift of nature that in order to study physics at some fixed energy scale, we do not know to know physics at all length scales. Otherwise, we would never make any progress. Okay, and that's the basic idea of effective field theory, that even though we do not know what happens at arbitrary short distances, we still don't know. I mean, definitely not experimentally. It is a miracle that we're still able to understand like pathetic low energy physics, like we're pathetic little humans in the universe, in spite of the fact that we don't really know what's going on at very short distances. And that's the power of effective field theory, okay? And the Greeks already were using effective field theory, even they didn't know about it. Good. So this is just to say that scale transformations is not something very exotic. You're very familiar with it in physics, and also when you do Google Earth, you zoom in and zoom out. That's exactly what you're doing. Okay. So, but as I said, most theories, in particular theories that have a length scale, are not scale invariant. So why are we studying conformal field theories? So now I'm going to tell you a few reasons why we study conformal field theories. So now, there are many reasons. Let me start with one. So the first reason is that asymptotic low energy, which we call also infrared behavior of any quantum field theory, is a scale invariant. That's intuitively clear. If you go to length scales, or think of, there are many ways to think about it, but one, I'm going to use a point of view that of integrating out. So if you have some, if your theory has some energy scale, like the QCD scale, if you go to at energies much lower than that scale, you don't see that scale anymore. So there are no longer any scales, and the theory will be a scale invariant. Okay. So take any system that you want, any Hamiltonian that you want, at asymptotically large distances, it will be scale invariant. And now there are essentially two possibilities. So I'm being there are caveats here with you know, but this is a zeroth order approximation to saying things. So there are things that one has to qualify. So there is one possibility that the theory in the infrared is trivial, which means that there do not exist local operators that survive in the infrared, essentially because the theory has a gap, and essentially all operators, all the correlation functions of operators, of local operators, go to zero as x goes to infinity. Okay, so that means that the operator x goes to zero. Okay. Now this does not necessarily mean that the theory is completely trivial. It can happen, and there are many interesting situations where this happens, including in some QCD theories, that there are no local operators that survive in the infrared, but you may have in quantum field theory. One of the things that we've understood now very well in the last years is that the theory has other observables other than local operators. You can have extended operators like line operators, surface operators, and so on. And even though you can have a theory that describes those operators, okay? And since this theory does not have local operators, in particular does not have a local energy momentum tensor, these theories have the property that are, they don't know about the local geometry, and they're described by what's called a topological quantum field theory, TQFT. Okay? And these gadgets have been very important in the study of what's called the topological physics of matter, in condensed matter physics or many body physics, but also in QCD theories in various dimensions. Okay. So this is kind of a pretty trivial theory, but it's still non-trivial. For example, these topological quantum field theories have the property that if you study the number of ground states of your Hamiltonian on a special manifold, the number of ground states will depend on the topology of that manifold. Okay. So that's very interesting. And then the other possibility is that you have a non-trivial CFT. So take any theory that you like, and do this kind of first, if you wish, the first order approximation to answering the question what's going on. First you ask what happens at the largest distance scales. You're going to get one of these things, either a TQFT or a CFT, okay? And that's it. Again, the little caveat that I don't want to get into it, okay? Good. So that's one of the reasons that we care about it. They're kind of ubiquitous. Okay. The other one is that any massive, again, this has to be qualified, any massive quantum field theory is a deformation of a quantum field theory. Is this something that's more or less intuitive to you, or should I elaborate on this more? I mean, let's take an example of a massive scalar field. Is a massive theory, right? Or the lambda phi cubed in four dimensions is a massive theory. There is a coupling that I mentioned full. But a useful way to think about it is that you start with some CFT.
So you meant CFT, any massive QFT is a deformation of a CFT.
Any massive, yeah. Mm-hmm. What's CFT, sorry, yes. So you start with the simplest CFT of all, a free theory. So take a free scalar field. And now imagine you're interested in studying phi cube theory in four dimensions, which is not conformally invariant. Then you can think of that massive theory as a deformation. Okay, so sorry. So this is a. A deformation of a conformal field theory. And it turns out that that's always the case. It could be that the original starting point is not a free conformal field theory, but a random conformal field theory, okay? So if you wish, the, even though conformal field theories are very special, they kind of tessellate the space of all quantum field theories, because any quantum field theory, I can get to it by taking one of these weird objects and deforming it in some suitable way.
Sorry, yes. By deforming it, do you mean symmetry?
Or? Yes, because the deforming it means that, I mean, this operator, say in four dimensions, breaks the scale symmetry. So yeah, so I mean, if you can also add what's called an exactly marginal operator. These are very special things that they don't happen very often, especially in non-supersymmetric theories, where you take a CFT. That CFT happens to have a spectrum of operators, and one of them is exactly marginal, which means that if you deform that theory by that operator, you still preserve a scale invariance. That's not generic. That's very non-generic. Generically, this will break scale symmetry.
Do we tune parameter lambda generally?
Sorry?
So do we tune a lambda parameter?
Not tune.
So we start from, what I mean is like from, we are increasing lambda to from zero to some finite value.
Well, this depends. Now the theory will tell you. You don't know. So it could be that you flow,
yeah.
And you could flow to a gapped theory, so there's a mass gap, or maybe by tuning a parameter, you could flow to a different conformal field theory. I mean, I can give you an example. So, okay, so maybe I should discuss this here. Are you familiar with the language of relevant, irrelevant operators? Yes. So one way to think about it is this. So if we take a theory, let's say LCFT, you can deform that by an operator O, okay? And now you can ask, I mean, and that's where the name essentially comes from. So let me do it in terms of the action. So I introduced the notion of the space-time dimensions, okay? So you have to answer this. So I take this theory, I deform by an operator in this theory, and now you want to ask whether the effect of this operator is important at long distances or at short distances or at all distances, okay? So if delta, okay, so this is called the dimension of this guy. If delta is bigger than d, how is this operator called? Sorry? Okay, forget about the word. Is this operator important at low energies or at high energies?
High energies.
Yes. So it's irrelevant. Because usually in physics, we always look down from high energies to low energies. So it's irrelevant going towards where we want to go. So this is called an irrelevant operator. Can you explain qualitatively why it is irrelevant?
Yes.
OK. So
let's count the mass dimensions. S should be 1. Dx is minus d, and so we get positive mass dimensions, so in energy
d. Okay, one way to say it is that if you compute any scattering process, you're going to have a coupling, say lambda, and now we have to make things in the right dimensionally correct. So lambda has negative mass dimension, right? Is that clear? So that means that this has to be multiplied by some power of energy. So at low energies, this goes to zero, so it's irrelevant. Likewise, if delta is more than d, okay, it's called relevant, and it's the opposite. This is very important at high energies, sorry, at low energies. What I mean irrelevant is always in the infrared. We always flow to the, you will see why in a second, we flow always to the infrared. You never flow to the ultraviolet, because that's not really well defined, actually. But and then there is the weird exceptional case where delta equals d, and that's called marginal, okay? So if you have a CFT, your first task in life is to list all your operators, and you put them in boxes, relevant, irrelevant, and marginal. And then you can ask the question that was asked. You can ask, what happens to this theory? Take a CFT. Now, if I deform by irrelevant operator, what's going to happen at low energies? You'll flow back to where you started. But if you deform by a relevant operator, all kinds of interesting things can happen. So usually in field theory, what we do is you study in the UV with a CFT, and you deform by a relevant operator, and our job in life is to answer what happens. Okay. And you can flow to another CFT. So let me give you an example that presumably you have seen. Before I get into that, if you haven't seen it, it will not make sense to discuss it. Have you seen the Wilson-Fisher fixed point in the 4 minus epsilon? Yeah. Yes, I hear yes or no at the same time. That's not possible.
We covered this statistical.
Yeah, this is where you would, I think. Okay, so I'm just going to do it qualitatively, and then maybe we can have an exercise about that. So we can study with this theory. Actually, let me do lambda phi to the 4, okay? Now, lambda phi to the 4 in 4 dimensions, lambda classically is marginal, right? It has mass dimension 0. Okay, so classically this is a conformal field theory, but you know that that's not true quantum mechanically. Okay, maybe I'll go back to that a bit later, okay? So now what you can do is the following. You can try to construct a short RG flow from one CFT to another CFT. So in order to study an RG flow that I can, so most typically when you deform by a relevant operator, the coupling, and one way to say it is the coupling becomes very, very large as you go to the infrared, and then you lose all control, and you don't know what the hell you're doing, essentially. Unless you're clever, and you use very modern techniques, but if you are well-versed in perturbation theory, you shouldn't even try to do perturbation theory, because perturbation theory makes no sense. But you can engineer some flow where the theory becomes weakly coupled, perturbative, all along the RG flow. And you can make exact statements about what happens along that RG flow. So the esoteric thing that we do is that we go to d equals 4 minus epsilon dimensions. Okay? Okay, so first we're here. So let's say that this is the mass coupling, and this is the lambda coupling. But I could add here a mass term if you want. Now, what happens if I go to lambda equals d equals 4 minus epsilon? All of a sudden, lambda becomes slightly marginal, just a little bit marginal. So I have a little bit of control. So it runs quite slow as you go to the infrared. And then by studying the one-loop beta functions of the coupling, you find that, okay, so first you discover that you have m squared is a very relevant operator. So if I deform it, these arrows mean, have you seen the RG flow, RG diagrams? So these arrows means that the coupling grows in that direction, and two arrows means that it's growing very fast because this is mass dimension 2. And this guy grows, but smaller, logarithmically. Okay. So what can happen is that by tuning parameters, and then you can have something like this. You can hit another fixed point. So this is the fixed point at lambda equals 0, m squared equals 0. This is known as free field theory. And now you here have this is CFT1. And then you have CFT2, which is what's called the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, where the beta function of lambda at a particular value, lambda star, is 0. The fact that you have a conformal field theory, you know what the beta function is, right? It's the dependence of the coupling on a scale. So a theory, in order to be scale invariant, must have vanishing beta function. Okay. So what you have here is a non-trivial fixed point that a lambda star, if you compute, is proportional to epsilon. So that's why is an example in which you can discover the RG flow from here to here using perturbation theory, because I can make epsilon arbitrarily small and it's self-consistent. And then you have this kind of nice RG flow diagrams. Okay, so this guy becomes, actually, so let me do it this way, sorry. The M square operator is still relevant all around this fixed point, but lambda phi to the 4, which was relevant from the point of view of the CFT, becomes irrelevant from the point of view of the CFT. Once, I mean, that's a very good thing for life. Once irrelevant thing becomes the other's relevant. So this guy was relevant for this fellow, but it is irrelevant for this fellow. So this was an example of what can happen. Now, in order for this to happen, you have to do some tuning. You have to tune the trajectory so that you're really in the horizontal axis. If you are not in the horizontal axis, the theory will develop a mass gap, and you will end up here, essentially. Okay. Okay. So, can someone give me other examples, at least of classical theories that are scale invariant?
I guess Yang-Mills in 4D or something?
Yeah, Yang-Mills, another one. Go through all the spins. At the spins of fields, I mean. So Yang-Mills is a spin one field. So yeah, the Yang-Mills theory. Ooh. So actually the most, all the equations that we usually write down in courses, actually they don't tell you, but they're at least classically scale invariant. So classical. So we saw that the Yang-Mills equations of motion are one. Okay, tell me one with the spin zero, the spin zero field.
Like a wave equation or something?
Sorry?
Like a wave equation or something? And when I don't have a mass, like Klein-Gordon with mass equals zero?
You can add an interaction. What interaction? Say in four dimensions.
Five-fourth.
Five-fourth. So that would be like box phi plus lambda phi cube. And also, okay, so the other one would be the free Dirac equation. That's also a scale invariant. Actually, if you have a theory that has a scalar field and a Dirac and a fermion, there is one interaction that you can write down that's also a scale invariant. Can someone tell me what it is? Yukawa, yeah? Because, yeah. So we'll be an example of a classically marginal coupling. But as I said, quantum mechanically, because of virtual particles, essentially the couplings, let's call it lambda, depends on mu, and we have a non-zero beta function in general, unless you are at a fixed point, like here. Okay. So that's why conformal field theories, in a certain sense, are sparse, but nevertheless very important because they kind of stitch together the whole space of quantum field theories. Okay. So I'm going to try to make this precise now. So I think this picture will be very useful. So here, this was an example of a very, very tractable example, an exceptional example, because most examples are not perturbative like this, where you start with a CFT that you know very well, which is free theory. And you flow to a CFT that where you can calculate everything, at least when epsilon is very small. Of course, in statistical mechanics, people do wild stuff, and then eventually they extrapolate to epsilon 1, which is, of course, completely uncontrolled, but you should ask them why they do that. I mean, but If you are honest and you keep two epsilon very, very small, this is a completely self-consistent calculation. Okay, the other point I want to make is that CFTs, it's related to what I'm saying now, induce an ordering in the space of quantum field theories. So let's start with a CFT. CFT, let's call it CFT 1. And I deform by a relevant operator. So this is relevant. As I said, this makes the coupling grow in the infrared. And what this will do is float another CFT2 in the infrared. So if you wish, you can think of this picture. You're starting in some UV fixed point. You perturb by some relevant operator, and you land on an infrared fixed point, OK? In the deep infrared. In the language that I said before, when I said asymptotically long distance, that's what I have in mind here, OK? So what we can do is we can assign, this chalk keeps breaking, we can assign a height function let's call it C that has the property that has a monotonicity property that if this flow exists, it tells you that that quantity, which is part of the DNA of the CFT, C of 1 or C of the UV CFT, is strictly bigger than the same quantity of the guy that you flow to. Okay? So there is an ordering. As you flow, they start from one CFT with big, large central, okay, large C, I don't forget about the word. So large C. And then as you start deforming, you're guaranteed that you're going to keep decreasing C, okay? That's very nice because it gives you like a map, like a, how do you call this? Topographic map. You have mountains and valleys. You know where things stack and what's the inclusion relationship between the various theories. In particular, if this flow exists from CFT1 to CFT2, you could ask this, okay, so something that you can prove is that the flow from CFT2 to CFT1 does not exist. If you can flow from CFT1 to CFT2, you cannot flow from CFT2 to CFT1 because of this property. Okay? That's sometimes called the monotonicity, irreversibility of RG flow. Yes?
So can I sort of tune like many irrelevant couplings to go back, or like is it?
This is something you should not try to do because it really doesn't make a lot. Because, okay, the number of irrelevant operators is always infinite. It's always infinite. While the number of irrelevant operators is always a finite number, except in two dimensions where weird stuff happens. So it doesn't really make sense to say, I'm going to tune an infinite number of operators and put all there. But there is no systematic expansion. There's no control way in which you can do that. But I'm saying that, imagine you were just throwing darts and you say, okay, I'm going to start with CFT2. I'm going to write down and deform it by all relevant operators. Will I ever land here? And say, don't even bother, you won't. You will fail because the C's don't have the right ordering. You can only go down, you can never go up in C. That's true to be precise, in a unitary means that your sum of probabilities is one, like reasonable things that you would tell your grandmother to do, conserve probabilities. So now the question is, how do we compute this quantity? So this I'll be schematic. So this C has many, by the way, C I call it C here, but it has different words in different dimensions. Let's not worry about that. But actually, there's a universal way of characterizing C in all dimensions. It turns out, even though in some dimensions it's sometimes called C, sometimes it's called A, sometimes it's called F. Actually, F is the more generic, universal way to say it. So how do we compute F? How do you compute C in a conformal field theory? So I told you that this is an intrinsic property of a CFT. How do you compute it? So the way you do it, I'm not going to tell you precisely how you do it. If you're interested, this is also an invitation for you to Google stuff or ask me for references. What you do is you take a conformal field theory. You will see later that you have a conformal field theory in flat space. There is a canonical way of putting that conformal field theory on a round sphere via conformal transformation. Okay, so you put the theory on a round sphere, and you compute the partition function, like in statistical mechanics, of the conformal field theory on the round d-dimensional sphere. And from here, you can read off C. The details of how you read off C, actually, the more precise statement is that we read off F, which in two dimensions is called C, in four dimensions it's called A, and actually in odd dimensions we just call it F, okay? These are details. So depending on the details where you are in even or odd dimensions, there is a particular behavior that you have to look at to extract this quantity C, okay? So that's just, if you wish, a way you compute C. But you could say, this doesn't sound very physical. What the hell is this C physically? Okay, so I'm just going to tell you in words, and I believe you're taking quantum information courses, or you will, or you are, I don't know. So first, I'll say that in even dimensions, even space-time dimensions, like 2 and 4 and stuff, this is related to conformal anomalies. So this is something that I will definitely describe in this course. So there's a notion of a symmetry, and there's a notion of an anomaly, and there's a notion of a conformal anomaly. And this is precisely the conformal anomaly, okay? But in all dimensions, and this conformal anomaly can be computed by looking at the correlation functions of the energy momentum tensor, as we will see. But in all dimensions, it also has a more physics-y interpretation, as the entanglement entropy of a spherical region in Minkowski space. I assume you have seen what entanglement entropy is. Have you seen what entanglement entropy is in quantum information? Yeah, okay, so I wouldn't say more about it now, but it's kind of remarkable that this quantity that decreases, you can relate it to something that sounds physical. Entropy sounds physical, right? More or less. And we know that this quantity, also that this intuition that things decrease as you flow to the infrared, also fits with this intuition of coarse graining. So usually when you go to the infrared, you integrate out short distance degrees of freedom. So this jives well with these words, even though there are caveats, because, for example, a topological field theory, which has no local degrees of freedom, has a non-trivial F value. But intuitively speaking, what's happening is that when you flow towards the infrared, this entanglement entropy is decreasing from CFT1 to CFT2. There's a lot that could be said about this, but let's for now, I'm just giving you some information. Okay. And so this gives an ordering in the space of CFTs. And since all quantum field theories are deformations of CFTs, this gives like a scaffolding in the space of theories. Yes?
Can I somehow connect this C to like the number of relevant operators? Because I mean, they should decrease, right? I guess.
So it's not, definitely not that simple, no. It's not the number of operators at all, no. It could be, in general, it can be an irrational number, as far as I can tell. Yeah. One thing we know, again, in unitary theories is that it's non-negative. Yes?
I just want to make sure that I'm thinking about it correctly. So it would be as if on that plot, I would put a height function on there, and I would see how it behaves in UV. Like on the space of coupling constants, right?
Yeah, so in the best case scenario, yeah. So In most cases, what the thing you can do is you can define this quantity at this fixed point,
yeah,
and compute it independently of the RG flow. It doesn't, you don't need to do RG flow to determine C. C is an intrinsic property of the theory. Uh-huh. The same, this theory lives on its own, irrespectively of the fact that it came from this theory. So you can define independently C1 and C2, and then the C theorem tells you that there's an inequality. One important property that this will blow your mind is that you're accustomed to think about theories from the Lagrangian point of view, right? You have a Lagrangian and you do blah, blah, blah. So one of the things that we will see is that CFTs, because of the symmetries that they have, is that sometimes we're able to discuss the theory without ever really discussing the Lagrangian of the theory. All that we need to know is that the symmetries and a way of describing the operator context. I'm not saying that Lagrangian cannot be useful. For this case in which the RG flow is perturbative, it is kind of useful that this is a weak a cousin of lambda phi to the 4, it's a cousin of free field theory, where lambda float from 0 to some fixed small value. But we will, at some point, we will study CFTs just algebraically. We will not try to write Lagrangian. We'll just say this is the operator content and the representations and so on. Yes.
Can I compute something like the Hessian of C if it's like defined along the flow?
Sometimes you can, and then you can show that actually, not only it is monotonically decreasing anywhere on the flow. So sometimes in two dimensions, you can definitely compute C along the RG flow. And the C measured here. So that C is not the central chart, it's some other quantity that's the homology of the find. And that more general C of the conformal manifold, the C here and the C here, here is smaller than here. But that one does not have a direct interpretation as a conformal anomaly because the theory is not conformal invariant along the RG flow, it's only the endpoints.
Yeah. Okay, but if I look at the second derivatives around the fixed point, can I read off the number of the lambda operators?
No. Okay. No, necessarily, no. No. Yes?
Here it's all or odd?
All dimensions, actually. This theorem is about all dimensions. So all dimensions has this interpretation, and in even dimensions has a further interpretation as a conformal anomaly. I'm going super slow, but what can I do? Okay, so the other one is that actually CFTs are also, apart from all this beautiful way of thinking about it, the space of field theories, conformal field theories are directly relevant for nature. So they describe phase transitions. So there are two types of phase transitions that we usually study in physics. Well, one that you have definitely studied, these are phase transitions that are driven by thermal fluctuations. So these are phase transitions that happen at a non-zero temperature, like the Curie transition, right, from a paramagnet to a magnet. But you can also have phase transitions that are driven by quantum fluctuations. That happen at zero temperature, okay? And there are many examples of both. So let me very, very give you an example. So let's take the three-dimensionalizing model, which I'm sure at some level you have seen. So the Hamiltonian of this guy is the sum of nearest neighbor interactions of a pair of spins. You have a lattice. I don't know how to draw it in three dimensions, but here's in two dimensions. You have a sigma I and sigma j. Okay. And this theory has a phase diagram as a function of J, or the temperature. There's only one scale in the problem, so J or temperature is the same thing. So we can plot, you can turn on a magnetic field here, if you want, to have an extra parameter. So you have a magnetic field, and then you have J. Now, this theory has an obvious symmetry. Can you tell me what the symmetry is? This will be very important. A Z2 symmetry. So the theory has a Z2 symmetry. So what happens at very high temperatures? What happens to this symmetry? It's unbroken. So at very high temperatures, you have a Z2 unbroken. What happens at very low temperatures? It's broken because it's a magnet, so it picks spin up or spin down. So Z2 is broken. And in the middle, somewhere in the middle, there is a phase transition. So here you have a magnet. So here, the order parameter for this symmetry is magnetization, and the magnetization here is zero, and the magnetization here is non-zero. Okay, and then here at the Curie point, the correlation length goes to infinity, and you have a conformal field theory. Okay. And there are many examples of, these guys are directly relevant for nature. I mean, there are many examples of systems in statistical mechanics that in the phase diagram, they have a phase transition. Okay, I can skip that, I think. I will not really discuss it, but actually you can see, I think you have access to some notes that are floating around from previous years. I described some example of a one-dimensional quantum spin chain that has a quantum phase transition and is described by a conformal field theory, the quantum phase transition. So essentially there, the difference is that, so let me just explain qualitatively what, so here I think you're familiar with what the phase transition is. So okay, let me, so in the thermal case, what you do is you look at the spin-spin correlation function. So you have a spin I and spin j. And at large distances, the distance goes like this. I mean, the correlation function goes like this. And the critical point is the place where the correlation length, let's call it GSA, goes to infinity, okay? For the quantum phase transition, you have a Hamiltonian at zero temperature, so you have a ground state. And then as a function of lambda, and then you have the first excited state as a function of lambda. The critical point happens in the limit where essentially there is a gap in the spectrum, delta. So the phase transition happens when lambda goes to lambda star and delta goes to zero. Okay. So that's the way you characterize a quantum phase transition. The gap in the spectrum closes at a particular value. And then I'll just say it in words because these are just blah, blah, blahs. Another place where CFT is important is in two contexts. One is in the context of, I'm sure you've heard many talks about this, in the context of the ADS CFT correspondence, where you have a conformal field theory that lives at the boundary of ADS that describes the dynamics of gravity in the bulk. Inside, so you have like a, you have like a can of soup. The label of the soup is the CFT, so I don't know, it lives at the boundary. And then that describes everything that can happen inside the box where you have quantum gravity. Okay. And the other place where, and that will be relevant in courses you'll take later, well, some of you will take later, is that conformal field theory is paramount to an understanding of string theory. So string theory is the idea that fundamentally, point particles, which is what all that we usually describe things by in quantum field theory, by local excitations, are actually extended objects. And the way we describe string theory is by a two-dimensional quantum field theory that lives on the string world sheet as it propagates space-time. And the one remarkable property of string theory is that you want to ask, so this string theory propagates in a certain space-time geometry. Consistency, internal consistency of string theory demands that two-dimensional quantum field theory that lives in the string world sheet guess has which symmetry? Conformal symmetry. So it's kind of at the heart of a string theory. It's not mandated by because we like it, blah, blah, blah. It's that if it's not there, it's inconsistent. The theory is just simply inconsistent. And then there are many, many applications of conformal field theory to mathematics, but I think I'm running out of time. So now in the next lecture, we will start more systematically developing the geometry and the symmetries of conformal field theory and the constraints that they impose on observables. Any questions? Yeah.
So can I cook up strings where this consistency doesn't require conformal symmetry, or
no?
No. So what if I have like a Bolshevik theory in which I don't have like a quantum gravity on the Bolshevik, but I have just some like random CFT? Do I still have this?
No, but. Okay, can you say that? What do you want to do?
Yeah, I'm just thinking because like when I write something like the product of action, I have some metric, right, and all this stuff, and I compute the conformal anomaly, and I see that the C has to be 26. But what if I don't have the?
No, it's worse than that. It's more than the conformal anomaly has to be 26. The consistency of propagation of the string in space-time requires that the beta functions, so that string couples to the metric of space-time. It couples what's called the B field and the dilaton. It's a very weird thing. So the space-time fields, from the point of view of the two-dimensional quantum field theory, are coupling constants. Why? Because let me write one example. So how does the string couple to the space-time metric? It's through this vertex operator. So h mu would be like a graviton fluctuation. But from the point of view of the two-dimensional quantum field theory, this is just exactly like a coupling, this lambda stupid thing I was talking about. Okay? So consistency of the theory tells you that actually that beta, not that C has to be 26, but much more strongly that of all the couplings which are interpreted as space-time fields have to vanish. And that's from here where how you get Einstein's equations. Einstein's equations, actually all of them, Young-Mills equations. Look how amazing it is. All the equations that you know and love, Einstein's equations, Young-Mills equations, the Dirac equation, all of them are a consequence of a vanishing of a beta function.
This statement somehow has like a perturbative feel to it somehow, because I write down the beta function, so I'm assuming I'm like perturbing it in space or something,
No, you can do a nonlinear sigma model. No, you can do, I mean, the Einstein's equations are not perturbative, right? I mean, if R mu nu equals whatever. You can do what's called it's not perturbative, okay? You can have string theory propagating consistently in backgrounds that are not close to flat space at all. Anyway, so as you can see, it's paramount to think. So if you were a string theorist and you don't know about Young-Mills theory or gravity, you would discover it by playing around. It's kind of an amazing thing to think about. Also, supersymmetry is kind of in it, under the hood.